Good morning and welcome to the Wednesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Times the Brief is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook of your choice at audible.com/thebrief and start listening today.
In the backwaters of Eastern Europe, authorities working with the FBI have interrupted four attempts in the past 5 years by gangs with suspected Russian connections that sought to sell radioactive material to Middle Eastern extremists, the Associated Press has learned. The latest known case came in February this year, when a smuggler offered a huge cache of deadly cesium, enough to contaminate several city blocks, and specifically sought a buyer from the Islamic State group. Criminal organizations, some with ties to the Russian KGB's successor agency, are driving a thriving black market in nuclear materials in the tiny and impoverished Eastern European country of Moldova, investigators say. The successful busts, however, were undercut by striking shortcomings. Kingpins got away, and those arrested evaded long prison sentences, sometimes quickly returning to nuclear smuggling, AP found. Moldovan police and judicial authorities shared investigative case files with the AP in an effort to spotlight how dangerous the nuclear black market has become. They say the breakdown in cooperation between Russia and the West means that it has become much harder to know whether smugglers are finding ways to move parts of Russia's vast store of radioactive materials, an unknown quantity of which has leached into the black market. "We can expect more of these cases," said Konstantin Malik, a Moldovan police officer who investigated all four cases. "As long as the smugglers think they can make big money without getting caught, they will keep doing it." In wiretaps, videotaped arrests, photographs of bomb-grade material, documents and interviews, AP found a troubling vulnerability in the anti-smuggling strategy. From the first known Moldovan case in 2010 to the most recent one in February, a pattern has emerged. Authorities pounce on suspects in the early stages of a deal, giving the ringleaders a chance to escape with their nuclear contraband, an indication that the threat from the nuclear black market in the Balkans is far from under control. Moldovan investigators can't be sure that the suspects who fled didn't hold on to the bulk of the nuclear materials, nor do they know whether the groups, which are pursuing buyers who are enemies of the West, may have succeeded in selling deadly nuclear material to extremists at a time when the Islamic State has made clear its ambition to use weapons of mass destruction. The cases involve secret meetings in a high-end nightclub, blueprints for dirty bombs, and a nerve-shattered undercover investigator who slammed vodka shots before heading into meetings with smugglers. Informants and a police officer posing as a connected gangster, complete with a Mercedes-Benz provided by the FBI, penetrated the smuggling gangs. The police used a combination of old-fashioned undercover tactics and high-tech gear, from radiation detectors to clothing threaded with recording devices. The Moldovan operations were built on a partnership between the FBI and a small team of Moldovan investigators, including Malik, who over 5 years went from near-total ignorance of the frightening black market in his backyard to wrapping up four sting operations. In the age of the Islamic State, it's especially terrifying to have real smugglers of nuclear bomb material apparently making connections with real buyers, says Matthew Bunn, a Harvard professor who led a secret study for the Clinton administration on the security of Russia's nuclear arsenal. The Moldovan investigators were well aware of the lethal consequences of just one slip-up. Posing as a representative's buyer, Malik, who was so terrified before meetings that he gulped shots of vodka to steel his nerves. Other cases contained elements of farce. In the cesium deal, an informant held a high-stakes meeting with a seller at an elite dance club filled with young people nibbling on sushi. In the case of the cesium, investigators said the one vial they ultimately recovered was a less radioactive form of cesium than the smugglers originally had advertised and not suitable for making a dirty bomb. The most serious case began in the spring of 2011 with the investigation of a group led by a shadowy Russian named Alexander Agienko, the colonel to his cohorts, whom Moldovan authorities believed to be an officer with the Russian FSB, previously known as the KGB. A middleman working for the colonel was recorded arranging the sale of bomb-grade uranium, U-235, and blueprints for a dirty bomb to a man from Sudan, according to several officials. The blueprints were discovered in a raid of the middleman's home, according to police and court documents. Wiretapped conversations repeatedly exposed plots targeting the United States, the Moldovan official said. At one point, the middleman told an informant posing as a buyer that it was essential that the smuggled uranium go to Arabs. He said to the informant on a wire, "I really want an Islamic buyer because they will bomb the Americans," said Malik, the investigator. As in the other cases, investigators arrested mostly mid-level players after an early exchange of cash and samples of radioactive goods. The ringleader, the colonel, got away. Police cannot determine whether he had more nuclear material. His partner, who wanted to annihilate America, is out of prison. This article posted by Desmond Butler and Vadim Goethe of the Associated Press. Sweden's Tomas Lindahl, American Paul Modrich, and U.S.-Turkish scientist Aziz Sankar won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry on Wednesday for mechanistic studies of DNA repair. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences said their work has provided fundamental knowledge of how a living cell functions. Their findings have been used for the development of new cancer treatments, among other things, the Academy said. Lindahl, 77, is an emeritus group leader at Francis Crick Institute and emeritus director of Cancer Research UK at Clare Hall Laboratory in Britain. Modrich, born in 1946, is an investigator at Howard Hughes Medical Institute and professor at Duke University School of Medicine, Durham, North Carolina. Sankar, 69, is a professor at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The 8 million Swedish kroner, about $960,000 award, will be handed out along with the other Nobel Prizes on December 10th, the anniversary of prize founder Alfred Nobel's death in 1896. This year's Medicine Prize went to scientists from Japan, the U.S., and China, who discovered drugs to fight malaria and other tropical diseases. Japanese and Canadian scientists won the Physics Prize for discovering that tiny particles called neutrinos have mass. The Nobel announcements continue with Literature on Thursday, the Nobel Peace Prize on Friday, and the Economics Award on Monday.
Along South Carolina's coast, residents were preparing for a second round of flooding as rivers swollen from days of devastating rains make their way toward the Atlantic. In Georgetown, one of America's oldest cities, Scott Youngblood was putting more sandbags Tuesday by the door of the Augustus and Carolina Furniture Store on Front Street, the popular tourist attraction that runs along the Sanpit River. Each day since last weekend's storm, which sent more than a foot of water rushing down the street, water at high tide has lapped against those sandbags. Residents are concerned there may be more flooding on the Black and Waccamaw Rivers, two waterways cited as worrisome by Governor Nikki Haley. Both drain into Georgetown County. The Waccamaw was expected to crest at 5 feet above flood stage in Conway in Horry County on Thursday. The Black crested Tuesday upstream at Kingstree, about 10 feet above flood stage, breaking a record, town officials said. Youngblood hopes things won't be as bad this time as earlier in the week. "We're hanging our hat on that we're not going to have that combination of tide and rain and such," he said. "We had so much rain, but the primary thing we were experiencing was the water table coming up through the bottom, bubbling up from beneath the flooring. We've had quite a bit of damage." Meanwhile, crews were working Wednesday morning to stabilize a compromised dam in Richland County. Sheriff Leon Lott told local news outlets crews worked through the night to repair a sinkhole that formed near the Beaver Dam in the northeast part of the county. Crews from the South Carolina Electric and Gas Company are pumping water out of the pond to relieve pressure on the dam. The Emergency Management Division said a reverse 911 call went out just before 10:45 p.m. Tuesday, urging residents within a half-mile radius of Beaver Dam to seek higher ground immediately. Lott said the evacuations were voluntary and he didn't think more would be needed. Tom and Christine Doran, retired teachers who recently moved to a riverfront apartment in Georgetown, were moving their belongings out Tuesday after battling tides and rain for 4 days. The first flooding was Saturday afternoon, and we kept ahead of that with a wet vac, and we thought, "We've got this," Tom Doran said. "Then it just started coming in from all sides. It was just too high. Every afternoon with the high tide, it floods up to 5 inches. After taking an aerial tour of damaged areas on Tuesday, Haley said that while the sunshine was a good sign, the state still needs to be cautious. "We are going to be extremely careful. We are watching this minute by minute," she said. She said evacuations may be needed toward the coast because of rivers swollen from the storm, which has killed 15 in South Carolina and also claimed 2 lives in North Carolina. In Effingham, about 80 miles east of Columbia, the Lynch's River was about 5 feet above flood stage Tuesday. Scott Goodwin, his wife, and their 2 dogs left their home on the river's bank on Saturday afternoon, concerned the day's intense rain would flood their gravel road and leave them marooned. "The water on the road was already up to the bumpers of their pickup trucks as they left," said Goodwin, 44, who works as a welder. Goodwin said they packed clothes to stay a couple of days with his wife's parents, never expecting the river could rise as much as it has. "It will be at least this weekend before the road clears enough for them to be able to reach their home." Goodwin is resigned to the possibility that the home and their belongings are a total loss, but comforted by the knowledge they have the maximum amount of flood insurance. Haley said it was too soon to estimate the damage statewide, which she said could be any amount of dollars. The Republican governor quickly got a federal disaster declaration from President Barack Obama, freeing up money and resources. Distributing safe drinking water was a challenge. In the region around Columbia, as many as 40,000 homes lacked water, although some service was restored Tuesday. Mayor Steve Benjamin said 375,000 water customers will likely have to boil their water before drinking or cooking for quite some time. The power grid was returning to normal after nearly 30,000 customers lost electricity. Roads and bridges were taking longer to restore. Some 200 engineers were inspecting more than 470 spots that remained closed Tuesday, including parts of Interstate 95. As of late Tuesday, that number had dropped to 436, the South Carolina Department of Transportation said in a news release. South Carolina was soaked by what experts at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration called a fire hose of tropical moisture spun off by Hurricane Joaquin, which mostly missed the East Coast. Authorities have made hundreds of water rescues since then, lifting people and animals to safety. About 800 people were in 2 dozen shelters, but the governor expects that number to rise. The Black River reached 10 feet above flood stage in Kingstree, breaking a 1973 record by more than 3 feet, according to town manager Dan Wells, who found himself involved in a rescue mission Tuesday. After a wild hog fell into the rushing river and slammed into the town bridge, Wells and a colleague shot the exhausted porker with a stun gun, trussed its legs with duct tape, and pulled it into a pickup truck to be released in a nearby forest. "It wasn't on my list of things to do today, I can tell you that," said Wells. This article posted by Bruce Smith for the Associated Press in Georgetown, South Carolina. Contributing to this report were Associated Press writers Jeffrey Collins in Columbia, South Carolina, Suzanne M. Schaefer in Columbia, Emery P. DeLazio in Effingham, and Meg Kennard in Blythewood, South Carolina. The New York Attorney General began an inquiry Tuesday into whether employees of major fantasy sports websites have won prizes using practices that appear similar to insider trading. The New York Times reports the Attorney General's office has asked for data from DraftKings and FanDuel, 2 of the most popular fantasy betting websites, to learn what rules and regulations each company has in place to stop fraud. The investigation comes after an employee with access to proprietary data at DraftKings won $350,000 playing on rival website FanDuel. Unlike fantasy football leagues where players set up teams for an entire year, daily fantasy football sites allow competitors to pay an entry fee in the morning, choose players competing that day to build their team, and receive their monetary reward at the end of the day based on how that team did, with the potential to win millions of dollars. A number of sports and sports broadcasting companies, from NFL team owners to Fox, which broadcasts the NFL and MLB, have either direct stakes in fantasy websites or promotional agreements with them. Since the DraftKings employees' winnings shook the sports world, FanDuel and DraftKings have temporarily prohibited their employees from playing fantasy sports on other sites. ESPN announced Tuesday, following the scandal, that it will cut elements of its broadcast sponsored by DraftKings out of its shows, but not the commercials it airs between broadcasts, according to the Associated Press. Attorney General Eric T. Schneiderman requested the names, titles, and job descriptions of any employees who deal with the sort of data that could give a competitor an advantage on these sites. "It's something we're taking a look at. Fraud is fraud," Schneiderman said in a radio interview early Tuesday, according to the New York Times. "And consumers of any product, whether you want to buy a car, participate in fantasy football, our lawyers are very strong in New York and other states that you can't commit fraud." Daily fantasy games have also come under fire recently for their similarities to gambling. Current law states that fantasy betting is not legally considered gambling because it is a game of skill. But politicians in individual states, as well as D.C., are calling for a reexamination of those rules in light of the current scandal. This article posted by Eliana Doctorman.
India's growth rate is set to further outstrip China's in 2016, with the gap between the two economies expected to widen over 1%, a new report from the International Monetary Fund, IMF, stated on Tuesday. The IMF's latest World Economic Outlook, WEO, report projects that India will grow at a rate of 7.5%, while China's economic growth will further drop to 6.3% next year from this year's 6.8%. The South Asian nation's economy, the report says, will benefit from recent policy reforms, a consequent pickup in investment, and lower commodity prices. The global growth rate, meanwhile, is expected to be lower than it was in 2014 and less than that forecast in the World Economic Outlook in July, with the IMF projecting it at 3.1%. The latest figures come soon after other recent economic surveys placed India in a highly favorable economic position, with a report from the Financial Times revealing it had surpassed both China and the U.S. as the world's top destination for greenfield foreign investment, and a simultaneous 16-place jump in the World Economic Forum's global rankings for competitiveness. This article posted by Rishi Iyengar. Former Fed Chair Ben Bernanke, Times 2009 Person of the Year, has finally released a long-awaited memoir of his time in office. The tome, titled The Courage to Act, A Memoir of a Crisis and Its Aftermath, covers everything from how he helped manage the financial crisis to why partisan politics left the Fed holding the bag for the recovery and what he might have done differently in retrospect. Bernanke spoke to Time about his most challenging moments in office, as well as the good, the bad, and the ugly he had to contend with on both Wall Street and in Washington. What follows is a lightly edited transcript. "Back in 2008, even as people like Hank Paulson and you were saying we're going to have to bail out the entire financial system, certain executives of certain banks were saying, 'We're fine, we're solvent,' in front of Congress, even though you knew they weren't. You are an academic, a truth-teller. What was that kind of double-talk like to deal with?" Bernanke. "So, of course, banks are not going to want to say they're not okay, because that will just make their situation worse, because they'll lose their funding, they'll lose their customers. So banks are going to put on as good a face as they possibly can. And in some cases, and I guess I would include Lehman in that category, there was just some self-deception going on, and people were not taking their problem seriously enough or fast enough. That was the stigma problem, the fact that everybody wanted to say, 'I'm okay, but you should lend to everybody else and get liquidity into the system.' That was a real barrier, and we had to be creative to find ways around that." As you were reliving the crisis to write the book, what do you look back on as the worst moment, the most difficult time? The crisis just hit its absolute peak during the Lehman weekend and that week. During that one week, we had Lehman fail, we had Merrill Lynch being taken over, we had AIG being bailed out, we had Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley under significant pressure, and they were converted to bank holding companies. We had Wachovia under pressure. It was a really awful week in terms of how many big financial institutions were just on the brink of failure. And the financial system was completely paralyzed. The interest rates for short-term money just went through the roof, and credit just came to a halt. You write in the beginning of the book that when you came into office, your back was really to the wall immediately in terms of taking action to fix the crisis. You write that there were no private takers for AIG for any of the toxic assets. I want to push back on that a little. There was a TARP Oversight Committee report that compared the way the AIG bailout was handled to the way that LTCM, the hedge fund long-term capital management, which went under in the 1990s, was handled. And kind of implicit in this notion that Bill McDonough, the former New York Fed chair, came into a room and said to the heads of the banks, "You know what, you guys? We have a lot of ways to put you in a lot of pain. You're going to buy this stuff, and we're going to be done with it." Do you think Tim Geithner could have, or should have, pushed harder and made that happen? Might he have made the private sector, rather than the taxpayers, take more pain? No, it was a very, very different situation. LTCM happened at a time when the overall financial system was in pretty decent shape. And at that time, it was not, as far as I can tell, all that difficult to get the other big firms to intervene and to address that problem in a private sector solution. AIG was a trillion-dollar insurance company, the largest insurance company in the world, and the other companies, including Goldman Sachs and Bank of America and so on, had concerns about their own stability. And that was why they were reluctant to do anything that would, first of all, would help competitors, secondly, would put their own stability at risk, and thirdly, they were very concerned. I'm talking now about the Lehman weekend and what they had achieved during that period. Their basic concern was, well, look, okay, suppose, for example, that we all put our money together and somehow or another save Lehman. Well, what's the next company, the one after that? How do we know that this is not just, you know, going to keep spiraling? There was nothing like that going on in 1998. Since that time, the New York Fed has come under fire for a lot of things, for being soft on banks, the Sagara tapes, etc. What's your experience with dealing with the New York Fed, and what could or should have been done differently in terms of how they interact with Wall Street? Well, I'm not inside the New York Fed, obviously. I deal with the New York Fed from Washington, or I did when I was chairman. But if you read, for example, Tim Geithner's book, he admits that they weren't tough enough in some circumstances. I think a good example is probably Citigroup, which was really hot. It didn't have very good risk controls. It wasn't able to assess very accurately what its exposures were to various kinds of mortgages, for example. And the Fed pushed them some to improve that. But in retrospect, it could have been tougher. So I think that Tim does acknowledge that there were some cases where they should have been tougher. I thought you made a lot of really good points in your book about how difficult the Fed's position was made during and after the crisis by the fact that there was just total partisan gridlock in Washington. Looking back, if there had been a bigger fiscal stimulus program or more being done at the grassroots level of the economy, how do you think that would have changed what the Fed did with quantitative easing, its asset buying program, and with rates? Do you think rates would still be this low at this point? Fiscal policy, except maybe for a little bit in 2009 into 2010, was actually quite restrictive compared to the previous recession. For example, in 2001, I give some data on this in the book, and we called the fiscal policy a headwind. On top of that, the Congress was engaged, as I discuss, in not raising the debt limit and shutting down the government and doing other things that hurt confidence and were probably also negatives for recovery. If there had been a better balance, if the Fed had not been the only game in town, the Fed could have done less. So it depends on how much fiscal response there had been. Maybe interest rates would already be above zero. And do you think that that would have been better in terms of bridging the gap between Wall Street and Main Street? Yes, I think so. There are many people who feel, for whatever reason, that the low-rate policy, whatever its benefits for the economy, may have some side effects they don't like. For example, some people worry that it's creating speculative bubbles. Others have raised, I don't think correctly, but have raised concerns about the effects on income distribution and inequality. And my response to that, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, is, well, if you think the Fed is doing too much, you shouldn't be complaining to the Fed. Complain to the fiscal authorities, because if they were doing more, the Fed could have done less. And these problems, whatever they may be, would have been less of an issue. So, I do think a better balance would have been good. It would have created a stronger recovery with less need for extraordinary monetary policy. Has that extraordinary policy produced bubbles? Well, by their very nature, bubbles are very hard to identify. It doesn't seem at this point to be anything that looks like the housing bubble going on. I mean, look at houses, look at stocks. There's nothing, there's no big asset class where it seems radically out of line. Okay, so you think that stock valuations and prices where they are now are not crazy? No, they're not crazy. You've got people on both the bullish and the bearish side in stocks. Now some people who are concerned about stocks say, well, the P.E. ratios are high. Price-to-earnings ratios are high. But of course, interest rates are very low also, and that accommodates a certain amount of extra price-earning ratio. A lot of people point fingers at the Fed about the emerging market bubble right now, the commodities bubble. Do you think it's fair? Is there a bubble in commodities? I mean, commodities are like the lowest valued they've been for a long time. Well, there was a bubble, and it's now burst, and that's unwinding, and it's having all kinds of effects. I think I'd point fingers at China before I'd point fingers at the Fed. China's very sharp decline in demand for commodities, generally over time, has been a major reason, along with, I mean, the United States has contributed to declining commodity prices because we've become such a big oil producer. But of course, that has nothing much to do with the Fed. Do you agree with folks like Larry Summers, who think we're in a period of secular stagnation with low rates and low growth for a lot longer? I think it's important to distinguish job creation from GDP growth. So job creation has been pretty good. It's true the participation rates are falling, and there's a bunch of reasons for that. But the last couple of years, monthly job payroll creation has been pretty solid. And so from that perspective, we're having a decent recovery, particularly when compared to other industrial countries. Total GDP growth has been sort of 2% level, which is not exciting, although it's positive. I mean, in the book, I make the comparison between the U.S. and Europe, where Europe is not yet back to their pre-crisis GDP, and the U.S. is like 9% above pre-crisis GDP. So we have made some progress there. But the problem is that even getting all the job creation, the productivity growth in the U.S. has been pretty mediocre since really before the crisis, since like 2005. Why do you think that is? Well, people who have worked on it say that basically the IT revolution produces waves of innovation and that we're currently in kind of a down cycle. It could also be that the crisis itself had some negative effect on productivity growth. For example, during the crisis, there wasn't much in the way of new company formation or startups. There wasn't a lot of venture capital going on. Capital investment was low. All of those reasons you might think would hurt productivity gains. Since that's the case, we might get some improvement as we go forward. But anyway, arithmetically, given that jobs are rising pretty quickly, slow growth has to be associated with the fact that each worker is not producing all that much, and productivity gains have been very modest. So that brings us to secular stagnation. Secular stagnation says that productivity gains are so weak and the return to capital is so low that even at zero interest rates, you can't get back to full employment. That's Larry Summers' interpretation. I guess I think that you look at the United States, that's not really true. I mean, we're clearly coming close to full employment now. Do you think we'll see wage growth anytime soon? Yeah, we could. We could if, it would be surprising if, even the weak labor market report we had last week. Still, the number of jobs created still was more than the number of people entering the labor force. So that means that the total amount of slack still went down, even last month. And as slack is reduced, and as the supply-demand balance in the labor market shifts in favor of workers, eventually everything you know about economics suggests that wages will start to grow more quickly. Although there will be upper limits to it, again, possibly because of the fact of wage. I mean, the productivity growth is not particularly impressive. What was the most difficult political conversation you had while you were in your position? Well, there's a lot of anger at the Fed because of our prominent role in intervening in Wall Street, and that translated into populist anti-Fed reactions on both the far left and the far right, and that led to things like demonstrators at the Reserve banks and at testimonies. It led to testy confrontations with congresspeople, which is still going on. And that's difficult, and I don't think that substantively that they were justified. But I understand them because they were coming out of disappointment and anger about what happened in the crisis and the slow recovery. So I don't know if I could point to a single example. I have some frustration about the fact that I would often hear different things in the congressperson's office than what I would hear in testimony. It was kind of, Professor Smith goes to Washington. But I could comfort myself by knowing that in the 30s, when we had another financial crisis and another deep economic downturn, that the politics was even worse than it was after this crisis. They had marches on Washington and investigations in Congress and so on. Of course, back then, the Senate hearings on the crisis triggered a pretty radical overhaul of the financial system. We didn't get that kind of response. Why? A lot of reasons. I think it had to do with the fact that the Depression was much deeper, and at the time, there was considerable fear that capitalism as a system was not going to survive. You were seeing fascism and communism gaining strength around the world. Roosevelt's view, as he expressed on a couple of occasions, was that strong measures were necessary if we were going to save capitalism. So I think, as I said, I think the level of discomfort, the level of distrust and unhappiness with the economic situation in the 30s was significantly worse than this episode. There was a lot more fear about possibility of revolution practically of some kind, or at least major changes in the political system, the economic system. So stronger measures were taken, and FDR had a lot to do with it. I mean, he was in a very, as I talk about in the book, he was a very experimental person. His view was that 1933, when he took office, that things were really bad and nobody had figured anything out, and that he'd been elected to find a solution. So he was going to try different things. And so he left the gold standard and he had the bank holiday and put in deposit insurance. These are the things that turned out to be really important. As it turned out, though, the changes that were made in the 30s were probably appropriately for the financial system as it existed. But the financial system between 1934 and 2007 evolved tremendously, and the regulatory structure, if anything, it was a little bit weakened, but in any case, it wasn't adapted to the changing structure of the financial system. Do you think we got Dodd-Frank wrong? No, I think there's some big important parts of Dodd-Frank, together with Basel III, international banking rules, that are very helpful. I would point particularly to the substantial strengthening in capital for large financial firms. The tougher regulation overall, and very importantly, the liquidation authority that was given to the Fed and the FDIC, which allows those two agencies to wind down failing large financial firms in a way that's safer for the system. And if, ex ante, if the Fed and the FDIC cannot be persuaded that the firms can be wound down, they can actually demand major structural changes, including breaking them up. So there are tools now, if the regulators are willing to use them, that can make substantial progress in terms of reducing the too-big-to-fail problem. You said recently you thought some people should have gone to jail and didn't. I didn't really say that. I was asked about the Department of Justice's strategy, which has been, at least until recently, has been to impose large financial penalties on big financial firms as punishment for various bad practices. And my response was, I would prefer a strategy where you look to, you know, if bad practices have been undertaken, whether criminal or civilly liable, presumably some individual made those decisions and made those actions. And why penalize the overall firm, which basically means the shareholders, and leave the perpetrators, who may be criminal, may not, but why not be investigating who did what and holding them responsible as individuals? Why do you think it didn't happen? I don't really know the reason. I think it was a questionable decision, and I would prefer to see if there are, and I'm not saying necessarily that that would have put a lot more people in jail. Maybe they would have gotten into it and seen that these were maybe mistakes, but not criminal mistakes. But seemed to me that would have been the better way to go about it, would have been to target individuals rather than fine institutions. That would have diffused maybe some of the political concerns as well. Do you think that the financial lobby has got too much power over regulators? They clearly have influence in Congress, although since the crisis, the biggest institutions have had to be a little bit more circumspect because they're still quite unpopular. I think the Fed may have had some intellectual buy-in towards Wall Street's point of view. I mean, the Fed as a central bank cares about the safety and soundness of banks, but it also cares about the overall economy and the provision of credit and availability of credit. And so there's a tendency to say, or there had been maybe some tendency to say that, to buy into arguments that, well, let markets take care of it, and so on. So there might have been some intellectual capture, I think, possibly being too receptive to some of the arguments that were made. What do you think the effect of campaign, serious campaign finance reform, would have been on your job when you were chair, the financial system in general? Would that be the big silver bullet to pull to make things easier and less politicized? One of the problems we have is that our legislature or Congress is too polarized. You've got very little overlap, if any, between Republicans and Democrats. And as a result, you get a lot of paralysis. And so the question is, what are the reasons for that? And it has to do with things like gerrymandering and the fact that some districts are basically not competitive. But one of the factors behind that is, presumably, is the fact that in many cases, a legislator running for office can get sufficient money from a relatively small number of individuals or interests. That's a factor that may reduce the need to reach out across the aisle and to try to spin the appeal to a wider range of people. So I don't think this has much to do in particular with the Fed. But I do think, except in so far as that because we have a very partisan, paralyzed Congress, that's the reason why the Fed has taken a lot of the responsibility for recovery. And I would much prefer myself, as being a moderate, that there be more compromise and working together across the aisle. And unfortunately, the incentives in our system right now don't promote that. Right now, a lot of people think we're in sort of just a long-term deflationary environment for all kinds of reasons. Technology, China, unprecedented monetary policy. What would the worries be potentially if we remain in that environment? Well, it's possible because the Fed can't cut rates below zero, and there are limitations in what monetary policy can do, absent any fiscal assistance. Together, monetary and fiscal policy can do more than just monetary policy. But monetary policy by itself, there could be circumstances, and I'm not saying that's where we are today, but one could imagine circumstances in which monetary policy by itself would have difficulty keeping inflation up to target. And if that were the case, it would probably be bad news, because it would mean that we were approaching a kind of quasi-deflationary situation like we've seen in Japan for 20 years. And one of the consequences of that, ironically, is that because interest rates in a deflationary situation are always very low, that takes away the ability of a central bank to really do much about recessions, for example. So you want to stay away from that. That's why the Fed has a 2% inflation target rather than a 0% inflation target. And it's looking like at some point, I'm not saying exactly when, but at some point the Fed will be able to get back to 2%. It looks like the way the economy is moving, which would be a good outcome. If for some reason in the future it found itself unable to do that, then some fiscal help would be great. Where do you see a risk in the system today? There are uncertainties about the emerging markets and their financial markets and how they'll respond to changes in monetary policy here and elsewhere. I think that's probably the area of most uncertainty. But we have a very complex globalized system, and so it requires constant attention to make sure that there isn't some problem building up somewhere. Is there anything positive that we might be underplaying right now, or a story that you think hasn't bubbled up that should? Bubbled up? Sorry, bad metaphor. That's okay, but I don't know, I think, again, so let me give you the best possible spin here. The U.S. was where the crisis was the worst. It's where the crisis originated, but the financial system was stabilized. The banking system in the U.S. is now very strong, strong compared to all of its international competitors. The U.S. economy has been growing now for 6 years, and it looks like it's going to continue to grow. Millions of jobs have been created. Unemployment has come down to 5.1%. People were scared that inflation, some people, worried that inflation might be very high because of what the Fed's doing. And of course, if anything, it's been difficult to get inflation up to the 2% target. So a lot of progress has been made since 2008, 2009, number one. And number two, I think the medium-term prospects for the U.S. economy are pretty good compared to others. And I would, when I talk about this in speeches and stuff, I usually point to three things. One is demographics in the U.S. are not that bad. We've got a lot of immigration. We've got decent birth rates. Secondly, technology. We're the world's leader of technology. And third, we still remain very good at entrepreneurship and developing new products. So I think that, I guess I would say that my overall view of the U.S. is that we've recovered more strongly than any other industrial country, and that our medium-term 10-year prospects are probably also the best than any industrial country. So this is a good place to invest, and despite political problems, it's quite stable. But this tech boom and this growth you're talking about, it is still bifurcated, right? There's the sort of middle that seems to be missing. What's up with that? Well, I talk about that too, and that's the fact that our economy is not producing opportunities in the middle, leading to more inequality. And that's a big problem, because what's the economy for, except to provide an improved standard of living for a broad number of people? I reject the idea that monetary policy has anything much to do with this. It's a long-term trend, and it's a combination of, I think, technological change, globalization.
Times the Brief is brought to you by Audible. Audible is the world's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment. From current events to lectures, from histories to mysteries, Audible has the spoken word content you need to keep informed while your hands are busy, but your mind is free. Audible is now offering a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/thebrief, download a title free, and start listening. Reclaim your commute and discover something new. Get your free audiobook today by signing up at audible.com/thebrief. Pro sports leagues and their franchises operate all kinds of businesses besides staging the games. They run websites, create advertising, and negotiate multi-million-dollar media rights agreements. Now they can add a far less distinguished accomplishment: insider trading scandals. On September 27th, an employee at red-hot daily fantasy site DraftKings won $350,000 in a contest sponsored by rival platform FanDuel. The employee had access to proprietary data that could have helped him gain an advantage. On Tuesday, DraftKings denied that the employee used this data to win the contest, but both companies temporarily restricted their employees from competing in daily fantasy contests on other sites. Major League Baseball, a DraftKings investor, said that it was surprised to learn that company employees can participate in fantasy contests. For the fantasy sports industry, this scandal has serious implications. It's already a problem for the fantasy betting sites that most daily fantasy players get taken to school by expert competitors. The perception that employees of FanDuel and DraftKings prey on contestants from the general public could further the impression that the game is inherently stacked against average Joes. The blow-up has drawn enough concern to capture the attention of lawmakers. On Tuesday, the New York Attorney General launched an inquiry into the daily fantasy sites. Two New Jersey Democrats, Representative Frank Pallone and Senator Bob Menendez, wrote a letter to FTC Chairwoman Edith Ramirez urging her to explore regulating daily fantasy. Consumers expect companies that hold online contests to do so in a fair, transparent manner, they wrote. Allowing employees of fantasy sports websites with access to non-public information to participate in online fantasy games, even if the games are operated by other fantasy sports companies, could give those employees an advantage akin to insider trading. The sports industry has brought this scandal upon itself. Investors in DraftKings, which has raised some $426 million to date, include Fox, which broadcasts the NFL and MLB over its airwaves and operates multiple sports cable networks, the Kraft Group. New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft is arguably the most powerful executive in football not named Roger Goodell, Major League Baseball, Major League Soccer, and the National Hockey League. The FanDuel investor group includes NBC Sports Ventures and Turner Sports. In a $275 million round of financing this summer, FanDuel, which has raised $363 million, said that a number of NFL and NBA team owners were on board. Last year, the NBA acquired an equity stake in FanDuel. By heavily investing in daily fantasy, sports leagues and the networks who support them have placed themselves in the center of an all but inevitable controversy. In case you haven't run to your laptop to sign up for DraftKings or FanDuel, Daily Fantasy differs from your season-long leagues in that you can pay an entry fee in the morning, build a football team or basketball team or baseball team consisting of players competing that day, and get paid based on the performance of your players, up to $2 million for some lucky winners. If that sounds like gambling, well, it is, but not in the legal sense. A carve-out in the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act of 2006 allowed an exception for fantasy sports, as long as all winning outcomes reflect the relative knowledge and skill of the participants and are determined predominantly by accumulated statistical results of the performance of individuals, athletes in the case of sports events, in multiple real-world sporting or other events. In other words, the law says fantasy sports are a game of skill rather than a game of chance. But the authors of this decade-old law failed to foresee the rise of daily fantasy. One particular DraftKings ad, in which a backward-capped bro nervously awaits the outcome of a sporting event and then goes nuts when the ball bounces his way, may as well scream, "This guy is gambling!" Pallone, the New Jersey congressman, has called for daily fantasy hearings on the Hill. Daily fantasy sports is functioning in a Wild West void within the legal structure, Pallone says. He thinks all sports gambling, daily fantasy included, should be legal and regulated. Beleaguered Atlantic City in his state could use the extra revenues. Time has argued this position, too. He's looking for consistency. Why can't someone drop a few bucks in a casino because the New York Giants didn't cover, but can lose a few bucks on these fantasy sites because Brady didn't throw that extra touchdown? The answer? Hypocritical sports leagues are pulling the strings. For example, the major pro sports leagues, plus the NCAA, sued the state of New Jersey to try to stop its effort to legalize sports gambling. The legal fight succeeded. In August, a federal appeals court ruled that New Jersey's effort to permit sports betting at casinos and racetracks violated federal law. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver actually does favor legalized and regulated sports gambling, but wants Congress, rather than state lawsuits, to overturn the federal law banning it almost everywhere outside Nevada. Meanwhile, the leagues pile money into what are, in spirit, sports gambling platforms and stand to profit off their success. Hypocrisy or not, these daily fantasy sites aren't going anywhere. The cartel that has effectively legalized sports gambling in this country doesn't just include FanDuel and DraftKings, the upstarts, each valued at over $1 billion. Among the disruptors are their investors and partners, century-old sports leagues and teams and networks, and the entrenched old guard members of the industry who have found a backdoor way to profit off gambling, while publicly and in the courts opposing it. In this insider trading mess, the daily fantasy industry may be facing its first big hiccup. But here's a safe bet. Daily fantasy is here to stay. Big sports always wins. This article posted by Sean Gregory.
Early in their careers, women receive more movie roles than men. That trend reverses sharply after age 30, as men continue to receive an increasing number of roles through age 46, while women receive fewer and fewer. This is often true even among A-list talent, Sandra Bullock compared to George Clooney. How much harder is it to make it in Hollywood as a woman? While male actors see their careers peak at the age of 46, female actors reach their professional pinnacles at age 30, according to a Time analysis of the careers of over 6,000 actors and actresses, and things aren't getting better in the film industry. Women today, who are the age of 60, are seeing the number of roles they are cast in decline faster than their older peers once did. At the same time, younger men are seeing their careers peak even later than their older peers. The plight of sexism in Hollywood recently reached the forefront when it was revealed that 51-year-old Sandra Bullock is playing the lead in Our Brand is Crisis, a role originally intended for George Clooney. And as Vulture noted recently, Hollywood is fond of pairing young actresses, like Emma Stone, with considerably older male leads. The problem is not a new phenomenon in the workplace, where men reach their peak earning potential much later than women. Hollywood is not only guilty of this same sexism, but displays an even greater disparity than most industries. Methodology. To collect a sample of actors and actresses, we compiled the top five leading actors and actresses from the top 5,000 grossing movies in the Internet Movie Database, which stretches back to the 19th century. While some movies choose to list the cast alphabetically, our spot checks suggest IMDb is good about listing the most prominent roles first in the cast list. The gender of each actor was imputed from the pronouns in his or her mini-biography, a method that appears to have very high accuracy. After parsing out those with incomplete information on their pages, we were left with a list of 6,000 actors and actresses who have appeared in a lead role in at least one major movie. For each of those individuals, we then looked at every movie he or she has appeared in and his or her age at the time. The graphs in the article show a moving total of roles over a 5-year period. For example, the value at age 40 represents the total roles a person received between ages 38 and 42, while the value at age 45 represents the total roles a person received between ages 43 and 47. This article posted by Chris Wilson.
One of the most significant partnerships in Hollywood began with casual neighborly chats between two dads. Steven Spielberg didn't direct Tom Hanks until 1998's Saving Private Ryan, but the pair had spent years as friends discussing their shared affinity for American stories. Since then, the pair have made the comedies Catch Me If You Can and The Terminal and co-produced HBO historical spectaculars like Band of Brothers and The Pacific. Now they're back together. In conversation hours before the New York City premiere of their new film, Bridge of Spies, the pair has an easy camaraderie and a shared familiarity with American history. Spies, which opens October 16th amid a healthy dose of Oscar speculation, sees Hanks playing James Donovan, a real-life insurance lawyer tasked to defend Soviet spy Rudolf Abel. Though his defense is only intended to make it appear like justice is being served, Donovan ends up not merely providing full-throated advocacy, but getting involved in prisoner exchange negotiations after an American U-2 pilot is downed over the USSR and an American student is taken prisoner in Berlin. It's a complicated situation that Spielberg and Hanks approach in a manner both unfashionably devoid of irony and refreshingly suffused with moral clarity. And in an interview with Time for the issue on newsstands October 9th, they addressed their partnership, how Hollywood has changed from technology to racial representation, and whether it's possible for filmmakers to make a real social impact. Time. Your last collaboration on screen was The Terminal more than a decade ago. What accounts for the gaps between collaborations, and what about a given Spielberg movie makes it seem like one that needs Hanks in it? Hanks laughs, "What is that?" Spielberg, "It's funny because a couple of times it's been my idea, once it's been Tom's idea, and once it was that we decided independent of each other. Once Tom read the first draft of a script and I read the first draft of a script and we called each other on the phone at the same moment and decided to do it together. That was Saving Private Ryan. That was the one time that he cast me and I cast him." Hanks, "You're giving me a little bit too much credit. I wasn't quite that prescient. I think I did some groundwork to find out if you were open to the phone call." Time, "What have you learned about each other's processes since Saving Private Ryan?" Hanks, "When we got to know each other as guys who live in the same part of town and had kids all about the same age operating in the same non-professional circles, we developed a language that was all about how we read history for pleasure. We were constantly reading biographies or histories, searching out the documentaries we'd never seen. From that came this dialogue based in, 'Did you hear about this? Did you read this? Did you see this? Are you reading that now?' It's no surprise that the first thing we did was based on the vision of history we never cease reading about, and it just goes on and on. Can't quite get enough of it. We really had this shorthand. His version of cinema is all his and instinctive. My version of acting is completely mine, so we never really talked about the specifics of it." Steven, "Jurassic World recently became one of the biggest movies of all time." Hanks, Isn't it the biggest film of all time? Spielberg. It's number 3 behind Avatar and Titanic, and it's about to become number 4 when Star Wars comes out. We're 3 now until December 18th, my birthday. Then I give it about 3 weeks before we are number 4. Hanks, Star Wars will come out and the world is going to tilt on its axis and stop revolving, and everything after that will be different. Time, how did Jurassic World exceed or fall short of your expectations? Spielberg, it exceeded not only my expectations, but the people whose job it is to prognosticate. It exceeded the studio's expectations and director Colin Trevorrow's expectations. Who could have expected this mega success on his first non-Sundance film? Hanks laughs. Now that guy's got problems as far as his next job goes. He's got to accept the fact that he ain't going to top it. All he has to do is turn in a good movie and he'll win, man. Talk about a sophomore jinx, man. His next gig. Time. Do you want to be a part of the franchise world anymore? Bridge of Spies seems to be as far from an expanded cinematic universe as possible. Spielberg. Thank goodness. I can't live on an alien planet my entire career. I've got to find things that are earthbound that make me glad to be on this planet and experiences when I'm making films that have relevance and have kinship to actual events in history. That fills me up. That makes me actually happier in this stage of my life than even a success like Jurassic World. Time. When do you know a film is working? Hanks. Never. I wish we could. The only thing we know is, hey, that was fun. Spielberg. I run a movie for myself the first time, and if I can forget I had anything to do with the picture, and I'm halfway through the movie and I'm just the audience, then that is my litmus test for a film working. It doesn't mean it's going to work for anybody outside of myself, but when I lose the aesthetic distance between the screen and where I'm sitting, the first time I run a picture that I've directed for myself, if I'm aware to the very end that I'm the director and all I can do is find things to fault, then I know I have my work cut out for me, and I have to roll up my sleeves and fix everything. But when I can watch a movie and I can forget I made the movie, that's the first sign that I'm going to be pretty happy with it, that I'm going to be able to live with it. Time. Your kids are involved in varying capacities in the entertainment industry, one that looks wildly different from the one in which you came up. What do you make of it all? Hanks. I wish that it would have been so easy to make my own content when I was in high school and college. You had to buy film and cameras and moviolas and stuff like that. It wasn't something you could just do. And now when anyone says to me, how do you get started in Hollywood? I say, if you're not already creating, get out. Because all the tools are at your disposal to put together any idea you want. And that can be for a great 20 seconds or it can be for a great 20 minutes. Spielberg. There are stories to be told in every format. There are stories to be told if you've only got 5 minutes between classes. You can look at your watch, you can pick up your phone, you can look at a 5-minute story. There is something to make you smile or laugh to share with your friend that maybe is only 7 seconds long. There is something today for everybody which gives voice to so many people who would never have a voice and who would have to go into the professional world with this iron ceiling to try to be heard. Today, anyone can be heard at any time. Time. Do Hollywood's changes, the degree to which traditional movies and TV are being encroached upon by a million other forms of entertainment, concern you? Hanks. My oldest son, Colin, he's working in television now, and the structure of it's completely different than when I was working in it. The money is different, the pull they have is different, the wake is so much wider now in terms of all the creativity that's out there. As an artist who needs to have the money in order to do what he wants to do, there is pressure involved in there, and it's tough, because the chances are the measure for success is either you are an ultra-absolute mega-hit or you're an also-ran. I think there's many more also-rans than there are mega-ultra-super-hits. That's just the reality of it. Now, if you can do it without having too much worries about money involved in it, then you can do any damn thing you want to, and all you have to do is put in the hard work. Time. Does this make you optimistic about greater representation at the highest levels of Hollywood? It still seems like most top actors and directors tend to be white, and in the case of directors, male. Hanks. What that is, for lack of a better word, the military-industrial complex makes the decision of what gets the attention. There's all sorts of influence and marketing that goes around in order to get those sort of movies as much influence and eyeballs as possible. You do not have to go far down the food chain in order to see the opposite of that. You name the minority, you name the diversity, and it's happening in spades. You can't find it, and it's not thrust forward because they don't have the marketing behind them. But if you want to, and you've got Netflix or Apple TV, you can see almost anybody of any color or any gender doing any story they want to. It's not going to be for a lot of money, and maybe only 17,000 other people have seen it, but it's there, and all you have to do is separate yourself. I've got to come up with some other name than military-industrial complex. The entertainment complex. Spielberg. Two of the biggest hits of the year are Empire on Fox and Straight Outta Compton. Hanks. And what does that prove? That proves there is an audience with a vociferous appetite for it. So the entertainment complex will catch up with it. It'll just be at a snail's pace. Time. What periods of history feel undercovered by film? Hanks. I don't think you can just choose the era or the genre, because that takes the inspiration out of it. It has to be something that someone discovers as the avenue into it. The best example I can give right now is what they're doing with Hamilton. If you say, oh, it's a play about Alexander Hamilton in colonial times, I say, well, give me a gun so I can shoot myself in the head, because that's just going to be homework and medicine. If you say, no, it's a hip-hop version. Okay, it's a hip-hop version. Well, tell you what, give me a gun so I can shoot myself in the head, because that sounds downright silly. And then you go and see it, and it actually is so prescient, because say what you want about the thing, but I saw it twice when it was down at the public theater, and when I realized I was watching a huge African-American man playing George Washington, talking about throwing off the yoke of oppression and the need for human beings to thrive under liberty, I thought, okay, this is brand new territory that is so salient to our lives today that I never would have been able to imagine it. And that's what's required, the new avenue into it. Time. Is there a common thread in U.S. history, something that connects the stories of Lincoln and the invasion of Normandy and the story of James Donovan? Spielberg. I don't think there's an easy answer to that question, because if there was a common thread, Jim Crow wouldn't have even existed, and Lincoln's intentions for his method of rebuilding or reconstructing the company would have been facile and would have been resolved before the end of the 19th century. I think the dogma of racism, if there's anything that has stunted our growth as a nation and continues to echo, is exactly that. Time. Can Hollywood make inroads against that? Spielberg. When they made 12 Years a Slave, that opened a lot of eyes. I know it was ancient history to some people, but when you see a movie that can transport you back to a time that's almost hard to watch, it's no longer ancient history. It's relevant to the young person who sees that movie, and it might reshape their values. Time. Is there one of each other's movies you wish you had worked on? Hanks. Dear God, well, you're fishing for something specific. I was just back from working my first season at the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival, and I was back in my college town of Sacramento, and I was working as a stage manager at a local theater company, which also meant that I was assistant technical director and built sets and all that kind of stuff. I had a rare morning off, and I was sleeping on the floor of a friend of mine because I didn't have an apartment of my own at the time. This other buddy calls me up, and we jumped in my Volkswagen, drove to the Century Inn Cinemas for the 10:20 showing of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It was the first showing. It was a weekday, so there were maybe 40 people in the theater, but this was a movie we had studied the making of without having seen a single frame of the movie. What was great about it, too, both me and my friends commented on it, had no iconographic casting to it. Richard Dreyfuss was a guy who worked for the power company. We had never really seen a movie where a guy who worked for the power company met the aliens. Spielberg. I have to say Philadelphia, because I knew Tom really well when he was making Philadelphia, really well, and I was making Schindler's List at the same time. So before we all took off for our movies, Tom cut all his hair off, so he brought his family over on the weekends to our beach house, and I've got videos of Tom with no hair with a baseball cap on. I knew the story, but hadn't read the script. I knew what audiences were about to see. For me, the proof in knowing someone very, very well and not knowing someone at all, but knowing his character very, very well, is when I went to see Philadelphia and forgot that I even knew this man, and saw one of the most noble statements I had seen in film. It was a groundbreaking achievement in the social context and the context of tolerance, and opening people's minds to something they were very close to in those days, an issue that was a clear and present danger to everyone. And it was really, that was one of the most shattering experiences I've had seeing a movie, when I knew the actor and then discovered that I didn't know the character. The knowing of the actor didn't knock down the fourth wall. Time. The role of James Donovan is self-consciously tamped down. He's a relatively anonymous lawyer whose special qualities only become clear over time. Why cast one of the most recognizable men in the world? Spielberg. This part was crying out for one of the greatest living actors. Hanks. I'm gonna get a banana. Leaves. Spielberg. I was able to snag one of the greatest living actors to represent the virtues and the principles that this character showed all of us in real life. Hanks. There's no escaping the countenance that goes along with the whole thing. Can't help it. I've been babysitting kids on video since Bosom Buddies. But if you're only giving the audience stuff they're familiar with, they're going to hate you. There has to be something new up there, and it's beyond my pay grade to figure out what that is. Everybody's burdened by that. There are a handful of actors that are truly mysterious. Daniel Day-Lewis is one of them. Johnny Depp is one of them to a degree, and other people that you might not necessarily know their names. Spielberg, Robert Downey Jr., Hanks, yeah, he can do stuff. But if you know their name, then they are somehow defined. There are a lot of brilliant actors out there. That guy's great, that guy's great. I don't know their names. If you know their name, your job is to surprise them. If you don't, you're screwed. This article posted by Daniel Diodario. Volkswagen's new chief executive has said the German car manufacturing giant will begin a recall of cars that were affected by its emissions scandals in January. Matthias Müller told a German newspaper that all cars that had software installed to cheat U.S. diesel emissions tests should be fixed by the end of 2016, reports the BBC. According to Müller, only a few employees were involved in the scandal. The VW boss refuted claims that his predecessor, Martin Winterkorn, must have known about it, reports Reuters. The engine at the heart of the scandal, known as the Type EA-189, was installed in 11 million cars worldwide. Müller told the German newspaper that the company would need to become smaller and less centralized and would therefore look into its numerous brands, including its Bugatti supercar. This crisis gives us an opportunity to overhaul Volkswagen structures, he told Reuters, adding that the firm could shine again in 2 to 3 years. This article posted by Helen Regan.
Microsoft unveiled a handful of new devices at a New York City event Tuesday, ranging from a potentially groundbreaking new laptop to a revamped version of its fitness tracker. Taken together, Microsoft says its new devices are all about boosting productivity. "We make things that help you make things," said CEO Satya Nadella. Here's what you need to know about Microsoft's new hardware and other announcements. Microsoft Surface Book. Microsoft saved the best for last, but this wrap-up doesn't have to. The Redmond, Washington-based company has been trying to replace your laptop with its Surface tablet lineup for years, but now it's aiming to redefine the laptop entirely. The Microsoft Surface Book is a high-powered laptop with a detachable 13.5-inch touchscreen display, running Windows 10 and powered by Intel's i5 and i7 processors. If the Surface Pro lineup is Microsoft's answer to Apple's MacBook Air, the Surface Book is aimed squarely at taking on the MacBook Pro. Microsoft's first laptop is an impressively designed piece of hardware that goes on sale October 26th, starting at $1,499. Microsoft Surface Pro 4. For Surface fans not looking to drop a grand and a half on a new machine, there's the Surface Pro 4. The 12.3-inch Windows 10 tablet is the thinnest and lightest Microsoft's ever made, a follow-up to the well-received Surface Pro 3. The company also says it's 30% more powerful than its predecessor, A new Surface Pro cover, meanwhile, brings a bigger trackpad and a fingerprint scanner for Surface Pro 3 users. The Surface Pro 4 is on sale October 26th, starting at $899. Microsoft Lumia 950, Lumia 950 XL, and Lumia 550. Microsoft's new high-end Windows 10 smartphone comes in two flavors, the 5.2-inch Lumia 950 and the 5.7-inch Lumia 950 XL. The smaller 950 runs on a Qualcomm Snapdragon 808 hexacore processor, while the bigger 950 XL packs a Snapdragon 810 octa-core heart. Both share the same 20-megapixel camera. The Lumia 950s start with 32 gigabytes of storage, but SD card slots mean you can expand that up to 2 terabytes once cards that big become available. Microsoft also says the phones are liquid-cooled, but didn't provide further details about how that works. By far, the most impressive feature of the new Lumia smartphones, however, is Microsoft's Continuum. Basically, Continuum lets users plug their smartphones into full-size PC monitors, opening up a desktop-style experience powered by a mobile handset. This is a core feature of Windows 10 and could be a big selling point to help Microsoft breathe life into the struggling Windows phone category. The Lumia 950 and 950 XL will retail for $549 and $649 respectively, starting in November. There's also the $139 Lumia 550, an entry-level device first hitting certain European markets. Microsoft Band 2.0. Microsoft's fitness tracker, the Microsoft Band, got a big refresh, but it's still known as the Microsoft Band. A new curved display looks to solve what was many customers' biggest gripe about the device. It just didn't look all that great. A new barometer sensor measures elevation gains for hikers or stair climbers. There's also GPS, heart rate monitoring, and other features you'd expect from a high-end fitness tracker. The Microsoft Band is on sale later in October for $249. Other stuff. Microsoft says there's now more than 110 million devices running Windows 10. The company also said the hotly anticipated developer's kit for its HoloLens augmented reality headset will be available in the first quarter of 2016 for $3,000. The Russian military's recent incursions into Turkish airspace don't look like an accident, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said at a press conference on Tuesday. He said the incursions lasted for a long time, disputing the Russian Ministry of Defense's claim that an Su-30 warplane had only entered the NATO allies' airspace on Saturday for a few seconds, driven there by bad weather. NATO says another Russian aircraft entered Turkish airspace on Sunday. The alliance condemned both of these intrusions, noting the extreme danger of such irresponsible behavior. I will not speculate on the motives, Stoltenberg said. I would just reiterate or restate that this is a serious violation of Turkish airspace. It should not happen again. Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, also warned Russia. An attack on Turkey means an attack on NATO, Reuters reported Erdogan is saying at a Brussels news conference. Airspace violations like these have turned violent in the past. Earlier this year, Turkey shot down a Syrian helicopter that entered its territory, according to a report by Reuters. The tension at the Turkish border comes as NATO warily eyes Russia's escalating military presence in Syria. Moscow began airstrikes on September 30th, sharing Syria's skies with a U.S.-led coalition that has launched airstrikes for a year against the militant group Islamic State of Iraq and Greater Syria, ISIS or ISIL. Moscow claims it is also targeting terrorists, but NATO has rejected these accounts. Stoltenberg said he was concerned that Russia is not targeting ISIL, but instead attacking the Syrian opposition, referring to claims that Russia is actually bombing the insurgents, fighting to topple Syrian president and Russian ally Bashar Assad. The 4-year civil war in Syria has already cost 200,000 lives and displaced millions. This article posted by Mark Rivet Karnak.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.